This episode is brought to you by Shopify. Forget the frustration of picking commerce platforms when you switch your business to Shopify, the global commerce platform that supercharges your selling wherever you sell. With Shopify, you'll harness the same intuitive features, trusted apps, and powerful analytics used by the world's leading brands. Sign up today for your $1 per month trial period at shopify.com/tech, all lowercase. That's shopify.com/tech.
Hello, everybody. This is Marshall Poe. I'm the editor of the New Books Network. NBN listeners like to read books and buy them. So we thought we'd tell you that right now, our friends at Princeton University Press are having a remarkable site-wide sale. You can get 50% off books, including ebooks and audiobooks, with the code 50, F-I-F-T-Y, at checkout until May 31. You can save some real money on Princeton University Press books. I encourage you to go there and check it out. Welcome to the New Books Network.
Welcome to New Books in Critical Theory. It's a podcast that's part of the New Books Network. On this episode, I'm talking to Natalia Guncheva and Elizabeth Stainforth about the geopolitics of digital heritage. So Liz, Natalia, welcome to the podcast.
Thank you.
Thank you so much, Dave. Thank you.
Maybe I'll start with you, Natalia. To kick us off, can you say a bit about what inspired the book and also kind of how your writing partnership came to be as well?
Yeah, thank you for asking that. That's really, I think it's a very good story to share here. So actually, the history of the book goes back to 2010 for me, when I started my PhD program and I started to collect data on digital museum diplomacy. And I came across really cool cases like Europeana that emerged around that time, and then Trove that also emerged a little bit early, and also Google Arts and Culture. And I have been looking at this projects at these platforms for a long time, as you can see, like more than 15 years for right now. And when I finished my PhD, none of that cases actually eventually was taken into my PhD thesis, but I was still curious about what's going on, and I was really looking into these cases. When I finished my PhD, I came across a really, really fantastic article on Europeana, and the author of this article was Liz Stainforth. And out of the blue, I just contacted Liz and via LinkedIn, by the way, and I said, hey, this is a great research. I just wanted to say, my appreciation for what you have been researching. So, and that started our connection. So, and once I finished my PhD, my first academic job appeared to be at the University of Melbourne. So I left Canada for Australia. And shortly after, Liz contacted me and said, you know what, I'm also joining the University of Melbourne because I got my fellowship to go to Australia for my postdoc research. And that, you know, we appeared in the one place together and we started to talk more about our passion to research these interesting platforms. So, and once she finished her postdoc and I finished my contract with the University of Melbourne, and we moved forward with our different plans in different parts of the world. So we decided that it's worthwhile to sharing our research on that platforms, and this is how the book came about. So Liz, maybe you can add a little bit more to that story.
Yeah, I think you're being quite modest, Natalia, because part of the reason I ended up doing the postdoctoral fellowship in Melbourne was through my correspondence with Natalia, because she had also done an Endeavour research scholarship previously. So she actually gave me a lot of support and guidance about applying for that as well. But you know, exactly how Natalia said, and that's never happened to me before or since, meeting somebody on LinkedIn and establishing a research partnership ultimately that way. So it's been quite it's been quite a long-standing partnership, I guess, at this point, and writing partnership with the book, it's been very interesting. It's been very interesting to look at digital aggregation, which was part of my doctoral studies. So Natalia mentioned the article on Europeana that had come out of my doctoral studies, which was more about digital memory cultures. And I was looking at it in the context of cultural policy in the European Union. That had come out of my doctoral studies. But I was very interested with this book how we could think about it through this lens of digital geopolitics, which we speak about. And in that way, I think sort of our joint expertise was really useful in that, because as Natalia says, she has this background in cultural diplomacy, which was very interesting, which is very interesting for me to think about aggregators through that lens.
Yeah, I think the book is actually a kind of really crucial intervention in some of the debates around heritage, and not just digital heritage, but heritage more generally, and framing it through that global geopolitical lens, I think is really important. And we'll get on to both geopolitics and some of the case studies, the international global case studies that the book uses. But before then, and sticking with you, Liz, it'd be useful to kind of clear the ground a little bit with a couple of definitions. So you've mentioned these data aggregators and obviously digital heritage in the title. So I wonder if you could say a bit about what those terms actually mean. What is digital heritage and what is data aggregation, or what are data aggregators?
Yeah, so I think the book is written in the context of the critical heritage studies tradition. So just to say a little on that first, that in that tradition, heritage is sort of defined predominantly as a process. It really emphasizes the process angle of heritage. So as a bit being about the management of time and space, and this particular telling of the past in the present. Thinking of heritage as a process also emphasizes its political dimensions. So you know, we look in the book at expressions of national unity, but it can also refer to things like an idealized vision of the past or way of life. And so I think the concept of digital heritage, on our understanding, extends that definition of heritage to digitized and born digital collections. And but I suppose to a greater extent, it's been focused on the circulation and reception of heritage in this context as a media form. So we describe in the book, and I suppose this is our particular definition that we're bringing to bear as well on digital heritage, that it can shape geopolitical representations of geographical space as well, and that's what we're kind of interested in. So digital heritage is connected to digital aggregation, I suppose, because aggregation is one practice associated with it, and in some ways it's a technical process. It's kind of slightly obscure in the background sometimes, but superficially it's about drawing existing collections together online. So rather than producing or creating digital collections, it's about drawing them together. The definition we give in the book is that aggregators are systems that manage data from providers such as galleries, libraries, archives and museums, and offers federated access to that data. So an aggregator could offer access to these collections from across different institutions through various online channels. I do think, as is often the case with definitions, that the practical definition I've just given is complicated by the fact that aggregation projects sometimes incorporate elements of heritage creation as well. And this is where the expression of perhaps geopolitical interests comes in. So you can see that in all our case studies, but I do think especially in the Singapore Memory Project and Google Arts and Culture. Maybe the final thing to say about digital heritage aggregation is that it encompasses a really vast amount of collections data, so hundreds of millions of items. So I think that's not trivial in terms of thinking about how it structures the overall environment of digital heritage.
I mean, the other thing, Liz has mentioned the digital environment for heritage. Natalia, the other thing is geopolitics. And as well as kind of giving a sense of what that means, I'm interested in why you chose that as the kind of framework for the book.
Yeah, thank you for asking that. So geopolitics basically refers to different strategies different nation states have are in regards to different geographic territories to pursue their different foreign policy objectives, or to pursue their economic, political, social, cultural interest in different areas around the world. So, and basically it's a very sophisticated game for, you know, struggle for domination. So, or for having certain, you know, kind of assets or you know, areas of power in different territories. So in the geopolitics, on the one hand, looks like really outdated concept because we right now living in the digital world, right? But in fact, geopolitics, you know, has its own, you know, turn of significance. So with their, you know, increase of their digital technologies and internet technologies that hyperconnect all us across the globe. Why so? Because, for example, imagine history is a giant puzzle, and traditionally each nation state had its own box of pieces representing its unique story through land, resources, or historical sites, military power, whatever. And that was geopolitics, the competition for power on the whole world stage. But in the internet has really changed things up, and now information becoming is the most important thing rather than military power, for example, because anyone can create their own puzzle pieces online, and this digital space has become a new battleground where countries and other players fight to control the narrative. So instead of controlling the territory over different, you know, hard power, there is like a soft power of control, where as soon as you understand how to create informational environments for the majority of populations, and especially for foreign populations, then you have all the ability to get what you want on the world stage. So, and because, exactly because digital heritage aggregators possess this very important storytelling power and power to create narratives about nations, about countries, about cultures, about histories, about traditions, they become very important tools in the very sophisticated game of geopolitics. So we thought applying this concept of geopolitics and digital geopolitics into digital heritage aggregations and analyzing them through these lenses is really, really important, because what we have noticed across all cases we analyze in the book is that really that territory, geographical territory, still matters how countries represent themselves and how they try to represent the other in comparison to one own country. So that's why the narratives of nation building and narratives of nation branding or regional cohesion or global imperialism, they play a really huge role in all these cases across digital heritage aggregation platforms. So yeah, the geopolitics has become a very important kind of framework for us to look into the cases.
So the book's got these four examples: the Singapore Memory Project, National Library of Australia's Trove Project, Europeana, which I've probably not pronounced correctly, and then Google's Arts and Culture Project. Everything you've just been saying there, Natalia, strikes me as coming through really kind of perfectly and strongly with the Singapore Memory Project, which is involved in, as you've said, kind of nation building. There are elements of kind of the projection of particular kinds of cultural soft power, and there are specific ideological contours to the project. So I wonder if you could introduce it and say a bit about what your kind of critical take is on the Singapore Memory Project.
Yeah, sure. Singapore Memory Project is a really interesting one because it's the only one among all those who which we analyze for our book is actually based on the crowdsourcing kind of activities, which has become super hyper popular in 2010. And the project, Singapore Memory Project, was devised in 2010 by the National Library Board and hugely supported by the Singaporean government. So around that time, you know, there, you know, crowdsourcing was very sexy concept, and it was really important to engage the audience and to bring all participants into one space to share their own intakes on different questions, right? So, and Singapore Memory Project became this nationwide crowdsourcing campaign to source the history and the cultural identity of the whole Singapore. Why it's so important for for Singapore because Singapore is a very, very young nation which gained its independence only in 1965. So, and imagine as a very young nation in trying to define their boundaries and trying to define their cultural identity. Of course, for them, understanding who they are, and constructing the whole construction of their artificial, because there is no such a nation as Singapore. I mean, it's all comprised of different other people coming from a lot of different countries, and the majority of them come from China, from India, from Malaysia. So altogether, they are Singaporeans, right? So it's artificially created nation. And for them, it's very important to build up their own cultural identity. That's why Singapore Memory Project became a very important milestone on developing this cultural identity. And it has a very, very strong objective in nation building per se. So it was a very good strategy, I would say, on the Singaporean government to bring people together for that, process of building a nation. And it was really, it looked amazing that all people, were invited to share their memories on the portal that they build online. And they had a goal to collect 5 million memories for around 5 million residents of Singapore by 2015, when they would celebrate the anniversary of their independence. So, however, it appeared that by that time, hardly they could collect 1 million memories. And after that, they tried to shift this focus from the quantitative side of memory collection into more kind of qualitative side. Because one of the observation of what was going on with this project is that it was really a massive effort for the government to try to bring all people together to share their memories. And the project was devised in that particular way that it looked like people were not that encouraged to share alternative stories of Singapore, and it was one dominant narrative created by Singapore Memory Project that curated the materials through different campaigns. So people could add their memories adhering to a particular campaign that the library shared, and that campaign had a very political message as well. Also, that was a very important nation branding building strategy for Singapore as well through this Singapore Memory Project, because it was important for Singapore to showcase their diversity, to showcase their welcome nature, to showcase their country on the regional and global level. So not only Singaporeans were invited to submit their memories online, but also all visitors who at one point of time visited to Singapore were, and especially for the regional audiences, that was a really grand step forward, because they were all amazed by this crowdsourcing, potential that the project promised to offer. So, yeah. With the government's goal to build Singapore as a global arts hub or the global city for cultural consumption to attract tourism, this memory project also served as a showcase kind of portal where tourists or people all interested who are interested to visit Singapore one day could find, different interesting stories about Singapore, interesting photographs, pictures of nice places, So that is kind of this nation branding component of the whole project. So I hope I answered your question.
Yeah, I mean, it's fascinating that although they're very different contexts, the Australian case study and coming to you, Liz, really has quite similar themes, actually, of who is included, who is excluded. So as Natalia did, it'd be great to get a sort of a flavour of what the National Library of Australia's Trove project was, and then I suppose the kind of tensions, contradictions, struggles over who is included and who isn't.
Yeah, I think it's really interesting to compare Trove to the other case studies in this book, because in some ways, but certainly compared to Europeana and Singapore Memory Project, it's the least overtly political. It didn't start off as a big political idea like these other projects. So there is something different in that, but its national framing, the national framing of the initiative and the place it's come to occupy as digital heritage infrastructure in Australia does make it, does throw up some of the same tensions that Natalia's highlighted. It's really interesting hearing Natalia, you reflect on Singapore Memory Project. We didn't have the opportunity to do that much comparative work in the book. We did some in the conclusion, but because of the book length, it was a short form book, we weren't able to do really in-depth comparative analysis. And it does strike me, there are just so many similarities between a lot of these aggregators, that ones that were conceived in the early 2000s and then so Europeana as well, was really kind of enchanted by this idea of crowdsourcing and what crowdsourcing could offer. Also this idea of scale. I think Europeana originally was kind of billing itself as digitizing or providing digital access to all of Europe's cultural heritage, which, I mean, just in the context of where we are now, seems so unrealistic in retrospect. But there was this idea of, I suppose, there's this quantitative drive for aggregators at the beginning, and maybe in a way, some uncertainty about what the resource should be put towards, that whether it should be put towards digitizing heritage or whether it should be put towards actually drawing together collections that already existed. And it went towards the latter because it was too resource intensive to try and digitize everything in the end. And there's a big thing about navigating scale as well. Once you have all this digital collections content, how do people actually navigate it? Which also explains a lot of focus in all these projects on curating content, telling particular stories, and that's where they sort of chime with particular, sometimes particular geopolitical interests as well. And in the case of Europeana, for example, supranational narratives. So I just wanted to, I suppose, reflect on that, this kind of interest in crowdsourcing as a way of getting people to participate, this interest in amassing heritage at scale, which is a common feature of aggregators, but also has kind of is a narrative that's shifted throughout their lifespans. So Trove is, like Singapore Memory Project, a national level aggregator, and it was developed by the National Library of Australia. So it's still managed from there, so by a single organisation, although it does have a lot of partner organisations now in terms of content providers, other Australian cultural heritage institutions predominantly. So it describes itself as a free resource for exploring Australia's cultural heritage collections. And as I mentioned before, while it is a government-affiliated initiative, it being in the National Library, the original aims of Trove weren't overtly political. It was created by a very small team at the library who were trying to kind of solve a problem in terms of linking up users to search for items. So sometimes those items weren't even digital collections or things that you could view digitally online. It might just be a record, or even in the early days, I think Trove linked to places like the book depository and things like that to say, if you can't find a copy of this book at the library, this is where somebody's selling it online. So I don't know if it does that anymore, but that was the original aim of Trove, to try to provide access to users to where they could get hold of certain items. So it was also built by building on top of existing databases. There's a long history in Australia of collaboration across geographical distance, because there are areas of the country which are quite remote. So they had the Australian Bibliographical Database, which was something that provided the initial infrastructure to build on. So just to say a bit about Trove, it might not be something that many people have encountered, but in Australia, it is quite well known, particularly among the research community. It's been a sort of quite a popular aggregator and been quite well used in research projects. And I do think some other aggregators have struggled to engage audiences at the individual level. So Trove is different in that respect. I think a lot of aggregators struggle between their different audiences because one of their primary audiences and stakeholders is also the institutions that feed the aggregator. So they have these partnerships with other cultural heritage institutions. Are they the main audience, or is it individuals actually searching for the items? So that kind of gets confused sometimes. But in Trove, definitely there is this individual user base. So the thing to say about Trove as well is that it's had, which I think has shaped how it's developed, it's had moments of crisis in terms of its funding. So the library's budget basically struggled to support the digital infrastructure of the service as it grew. And I think, yeah, in the chapter, we argue that this influenced its self-presentation. So it's definitely shifted. In its latest strategy, Trove foregrounds its role as an essential part of Australia's heritage infrastructure, and describes its ambition to become Australia's sovereign cultural resource. From its quite humble beginnings, this is like, represents very much a change of direction. And in the chapter, we write about how becoming a digital infrastructure has bigger implications for Trove as a tool of cultural diplomacy and soft power. So it becomes this appealing projection of Australia's national culture abroad, potentially, or certainly feeds into that kind of projection of Australia abroad. So I do think there's a tension between those kinds of geopolitical goals and the library's efforts to represent the diverse histories of the Australian people, including First Nations Australians. Trove has in recent years put resource and time into redesigning its service to be more inclusive, as well as respecting the cultural sensitivities around Indigenous heritage. But drawing from the idea of geopolitics from below, we argue that First Nations' claim for recognition in Australia present a challenge to the legitimacy of colonial settlement and the founding principles of the modern nation. So basically, the national framing of Trove and that idea of the nation as the modern founding of Australia is in tension with these First Nations claims for recognition. You can sort of see that that's sort of very intractable, really. So it's not to say that Indigenous heritage shouldn't be included or it shouldn't be a part of Trove. It's just how that's navigated and what the limitations of that are in a system, an aggregation system like this. So I think that's what really came out of the case study. It threw into sharp relief the relation of aggregation to knowledge practices that underpin the foundation of modern nation states, and then revealed those limitations, as I said, of being able to present the complex national story of Australia. So we looked at a particular case study where a crowdsourcing initiative, actually, where they had solicited images for from an event, a national holiday in Australia, which is called Australia Day, which is a very contested event because it's about the founding of it represents the point at which, you know, the discovery of Australia, so-called. But it's also been a day, as I say, contested throughout its history. Concurrently with the celebration of Australian Day have been Invasion Day rallies, protests staged by First Nations Australians to about this national holiday. And I think this wasn't necessarily something in a crowdsourced initiative where you frame the topic as Australia Day. It maybe minimises that other side of the story of Australia Day. So that was just one example where the tensions that I was talking about really are really brought out. And as I say, I think it is quite intractable, but it's an interesting way of thinking. And as I say, in a way, a bit of a counterpoint, trying to think of this geopolitics from below in relation to the digital geopolitics that we're talking about in a lot of the other case studies.
I mean, you mentioned Europeana. I think I've got that right now. And it struck me reading it, and I know you've also mentioned, you know, the book is not a kind of specifically comparative text. But it struck me actually these inclusions and exclusions of there with that project too. You'd sort of talked already about, I suppose, the kind of the technical task of digitizing all of European culture. But I was quite interested in two things that were going on with that project. One was this, what is European culture question? And again, sort of sticking with you on this case study, Liz. The other thing, though, was this sense of, I guess, the project being really about the EU describing itself as the EU, having a coherence as a kind of global political actor, as much as it was a kind of digital culture project. So I'm interested to hear these kind of two themes that provided the framework for your analysis.
Yeah, I mean, as Natalia mentioned, Europeana was a case study that we had both worked on in the past. And I think in a way it brought us together in terms of our research. It was originally a common point of interest in our research. And I do think that Europeana is also one of the most studied aggregators, in part because it was conceived as this big political idea and because it's directly informed by EU politics. So I think it kind of lends itself in some way to academic study. Yeah, it's funny you talk about the name Europeana. It very much reflects that idea of of the branding element, but it is difficult to say. So I'll just give a little bit of background, which we go over in the book. It was originally, the idea for Europeana was originally proposed by the former director of the National Library in France as a European open rights alternative to Google Books. So this is an interesting aspect because, as you say, a lot of the EU's cultural policy agenda has been about fostering this sense of cultural social cohesion between EU member states. But also a lot of its initiatives have been about, I think, that idea of presenting this this coherent idea of European identity, and obviously this extends to the digital realm, has also been in opposition to other kinds of cultures, or in this case, the idea of representing a European open alternative to the market-driven approach of a company like Google and Google Books. So certainly it perceived Google Books or people like the former director of the National Library in France perceived Google Books as a threat to European heritage and European digital heritage, the life that European heritage was going to have in the digital realm, because there was this view of Google Books as something that was going to privatise European cultural works. And so this idea of it being open was very important at the beginning. I do think it represents, that whole view in a way represents a fundamental misunderstanding of what Google Books was. Obviously, it was this project to try and digitise the world's books. Again, hugely ambitious, all the books in the world to digitise them, which it did give up on as well. But I think thinking about Google's trajectory and how it's changed, it was also very tied into its business model. So it does have these kind of corporate responsibility arms, and Google Arts and Culture originally started off that way. But when I asked the former director of Google Arts and Culture, I think it was back in 2013, about whether Google Books was connected to what he did, he was very emphatic and said, no, absolutely not. Google Books is part of Google's business model. And of course, it was very much connected to them being able to do text mining of the digitized books and also to be able to collect data based on what users search for, which obviously feeds its search engine and that side of its business. So it's interesting at this point when the project was first conceived in 2005, there wasn't a good understanding about that, about what Google actually represented. But this idea of opposing these market-driven approaches and the commercial internet has persisted, and obviously it persists in EU in EU policy as well, in terms of trying to be a data regulator or have, as I come to talk about, digital be digitally sovereign. That's a debate that's influenced a lot of like e-digital policy in recent years, I think. So to go back to the timeline, Europeana, as I sort of alluded to, it fitted in with the EU's agenda to promote shared European values and culture. The aggregator itself was launched in 2008, and then it's continued to expand, drawing together the cultural data from museums, libraries and archives in Europe, which actually is a really complicated task because of the different language cultures involved. And Europeana historically hasn't been great at multilingualism, but it is trying to embed being able to kind of represent the data it draws together multilingually now as well. So it's very interesting now. This is a connection to Trove that I hadn't quite made in my head before writing the book, that Europeana has also started to position itself more as a digital heritage infrastructure in recent years. So Trove has definitely become that. That's become kind of quite essential in terms of justifying its reason for being. And Europeana has moved in a similar direction. And as I sort of hinted at, I think it's connected to the EU's geopolitical agenda of becoming digitally sovereign. So this is broadly understood as the ability to act independently in the digital world, particularly most recently in matters of kind of data protection. So digital sovereignty is related to concerns also on the kind of commercial side around European economics and the dependence on non-EU technologies and platforms. So I do think, and this is what we argue in the book, that the impact of debates about digital sovereignty can be read into Europeana's portrayal of itself as part of a larger ecosystem and European infrastructure in its latest strategy. And that's to do with its funding model as well, which has changed, and it's now consciously aligned with programs like the European Data Strategy, and their plans to leverage the potential of big data. So in that way, rather than creating heritage, which it has been involved in these campaigns to crowdsource heritage, like Trove, like Singapore Memory Project, but rather than doing that now, I think it increasingly is trying to focus its efforts on being a broker between institutions, cultural institutions, and maybe sites that users routinely use. So maybe to find tourist information and things like that. There have been discussions about that, you know, what the economic potential leveraging big data is, and Europeana has become bound up in that, I think. Which is really interesting because it started off very much as like this kind of very cultural heritage based initiative, very much about presenting or providing access to an authoritative source of information. So it's very interesting that it's moved much further towards providing data for heritage tourism platforms. So almost becoming closer to something like Singapore Memory Project, even though it didn't start off that way. But anyway, in the book, I think ultimately we're trying to say that this idea of a European heritage infrastructure, when you think of infrastructure as something in the background, I think for the EU, it's very much about attaining a foothold in the global technology sector and infrastructure in a way being more in the foreground as a distinctive marker and promoter of the European brand and what it stands for, and those kind of norms and values of the EU as well, in terms of how it kind of its self-presentation.
You talked about the comparison with Google and I guess the kind of commercial imperatives that Google is following. And Natalia, coming back to you, I'm intrigued by, I guess, the kind of the difference that the Google Arts and Culture Project has. It's kind of, I suppose, the odd one out of the four case studies, but also, and Liz has kind of touched on this already, the kind of things that were driving its project, which on the surface sounds kind of incredible and amazing, but actually one of the things you're critical of is the idea of, a platform imperialism that was going on. So what's the story of Google's arts and culture project?
Google Arts and Culture is a really interesting case study in the book, and it looks like it's really odd out. But in fact, the whole framework of digital geopolitics was applied to 4K study to allow us to include Google Arts and Culture, because contemporary digital geopolitics cannot operate without this big new actors, new economic actors who are very, very powerful, in many cases much powerful than many nation states that exist, right? So, and this mega popular transnational corporations like Google become very important players in contemporary geopolitics exactly because of their power to build together this platform that has really large viewership and audienceship, and they can manipulate the narratives of our cultures and histories, and they can really shape up the informational environments of people. That's why Google Arts and Culture is a part of a bigger ecosystem of digital heritage aggregation. So Google Arts and Culture started in 2010 or around that time, and it started with really a few museums joining in with a few of their collections, digitized artworks or artifacts being presented in the gallery in the first Google Arts and Culture platform right now. But it grew really fast in the past decade. It was very successful to attract right now many partnerships with different museums. And right now it's sealed, I think, contracts with 2,000 cultural institutions around the world. And it has around 6 million objects from different museums coming from different continents except Antarctica. So during the time of the pandemic, it really turned out that Google Arts and Culture, quadrupled their, viewership and audience visit per day, because many people, as you can imagine, couldn't visit physical museums, but Google Arts and Culture provide this amazing opportunities for people to go different countries and really, browse the collections of museums and also to enjoy the virtual tours of the museums. What also Google did in the very beginning, and it actually helped the Google to attract a lot of museums to come into this partnership, is they provided a lot of free resources and free support to digitize their collections, because for many cultural institutions, the whole process is very time consuming and also very, very expensive. So it also depends on the access to different digital technologies that allow a high quality resolution digitization of artifacts, which is very important because all museums build around the idea of authenticity and presenting the true information to their audiences. So what also the good strategies of Google is that it very quickly, in a couple of years or in 3 years, it expanded its reach beyond the museum and started to collaborate with theaters, performance art spaces, fashion shows, science centers, and the list goes on. So they really intended to include as much culture as possible on their platform. And like Liz mentioned, they had a big reason for doing that. And the whole reason is their economic model. The more information they have included, the more information is available for their audience, the more information they can get, and the more data they can get from their visitors, then eventually feed their whole income generation. And that's how cultural platform imperialism appears as a new phenomenon in the 21st century, where we see the efforts of a transnational corporation that with a very strong economic interest to aggregate all this cultural heritage information into one space, because it's a part of the economic business model. So, and does it have implications for heritage consumption? Of course it does. So when heritage is understood as just the product of cultural consumption for global audiences, then definitely it is no longer presented in the way it should be. So it inspires really deep exploration and authentic exploration and encounter with the heritage from different cultures and different country contexts. So for Google Arts and Culture platform, culture is just a product for sale on the global level, and it should be as attractive as possible for global audiences. So inevitably, the process that step into this representation of cultural heritage is Disneyfication and commodification, right? So presenting the heritage in a way that it actually attracts the users to consume these amazing stories about different countries around the world. So eventually all the difficult moments or all the hard moments about the history traditions are being excluded for these representations, and the big stress is made on what is more appealing, right? So that's why one of the most important objectives for Google Arts and Culture right now is a shift from collaborating with institutions, specific institutions, to collaboration with governments of different countries, and specifically with the tourism departments of different countries, who are also eager to sell their arts and cultural heritage to be a part of a bigger platform so that it increases their digital tourism consumption, so that eventually brings more visitors to the country. So these are very huge implications if we think about our cultural heritage being presented in that way. What also steps in here, so Google very active with new technologies coming up, so it plays a lot, for example, right now with artificial intelligence, and allows different designers or creative digital makers to really come into these artifacts as a part of the Google Arts and Culture One platform, right? And to recontextualize them, to use them in different new contexts, to play with them. And again, it is just leads people away from all the stories of these artifacts. And again, it becomes just a toy for play. So a contemporary toy, so for users to play with in their digital environments. The implications are profound for our future. That's why I think European, or those who devised the whole platform, were very much concerned what would happen to our heritage in the European context if one day everything is just controlled by one heritage, digital heritage stakeholder, which is not a government, which is not a any other kind of actor, it's just a transnational corporation on the world stage. So, yeah.
I mean, there's a lot in there that I suppose gestures towards the kind of future problems or maybe future issues that we're going to find for these digital heritage projects. But I think that's something where it's worth people kind of reading the book, reading the conclusion, because there's a lot we actually haven't, had time to touch on. As we wrap up, though, I'm interested slightly less in the kind of future for digital aggregators and slightly more in your own work. So maybe I'll come first to Liz and then back to you, Natalia. Are you working on these kind of questions of digital heritage and aggregation, or are you doing something different? And indeed, are you going to be doing more work together in the future too?
Thanks for asking the question. Yeah, it's given me pause for thought, actually, because I was very engaged in thinking about the future of digital aggregators in preparation for the conversation today. And I do think, I'm not sure where the future lies in terms of my work in aggregation. I can see myself still working on it, because I do have other collaborators. I've worked on the Aggregator Digital Public Library of America as well with a colleague in the US. So I can see doing more work on this kind of thing in the future. I think I am very interested in the history of these kinds of projects, and as I sort of was mentioning in relation to Europeana, that kind of mismatch between the vision of information discovery promised in the metaphor of the library, because a lot of these projects actually started life as in the idea of being a digital library, a proposal for a digital library. And I think there's a real mismatch between that and the reality of commercial algorithmically driven search engines, which nevertheless also started off life, in their creators' minds, using the library metaphor, because at the time that the creators of Google were developing search, there were a lot of web directories out there online, which, you know, that this kind of indexing websites, which is very much connected to that history of library activity. So, and I think so I'm interested in that. I'm interested in working more on that and thinking more about that in terms of, from a sort of media historical perspective in the future. Also, I work on the history of utopia and kind of utopian visions. And I think I want to return to that this question of utopia in the context of history, specifically looking at techno-utopias, because I've actually never done that before. I work a lot on digital culture and memory, and I also work on utopia, heritage and history, but I haven't always in my published work brought the two together. So I thinking about the history of techno-utopian visions might be, although it's not very well developed yet, it might be one future trajectory for my research.
And what about you, Natalia?
Thank you for asking, Dave. So yeah, indeed, the project was really fascinating. And I think in the conclusion of our book, we mentioned that one thing that really left out from our in-depth conversation in the book and in-depth analysis is digital audiences of all these projects. So, and I'm very, very passionate about this question. And I'm very interested what actually happens to people and if this power of narrative does actually influence people, because we live in the 21st century, right? And we are talking about active audiences who look at different things through their own lenses and bring into the table their own experiences and their own cultural heritage, how they understand different things. So it's really, so on the one hand, what we've done in the book is we looked how these narratives are being built by all these different actors on their stage of digital geopolitics. But on the other end, as a huge question and answer, like how are they actually perceived and who are these people who are consuming all these stories and what they think about that. And in this regard, I'm working on the new project right now. And actually I'm very happy to share this right now that I got another contract from Cambridge University Press for another book, which is actually due this December in this year, which is called Digital Soft Power of Heritage Media, where I'm going to look at, the consumption of these digital heritage narratives on the one hand, and to look at different ways how these consumptions could be measured or how these perceptions of audiences could be evaluated on the one hand. And also what I'm also really interested about is how they're, because all museums and their archives, they stress the idea of authenticity, and the material objects per se, they have a very high value, cultural, economic, social, whatever, like very high value. But if we are bringing all these things into the digital realm, does the materiality of objects still matter? So this is my big question for Digital Soft Power of Heritage Media book, is to explore to what extent the material power of objects or how it translates into the digital realm, and if it translates, and if it does, what is the value of of this virtualism in comparison to materialism of heritage. So yeah, thank you for asking.